The aging population in Canada has been a known challenge to our economy for decades. Canada's labor force isn't growing fast enough to keep up with our aging population. On one hand, we have a labor supply challenge. On the other hand, the workers we do have don't always have the skill sets that we need today, but particularly the skills we'll need in the future. In this episode, we explore how post-secondary institutions and skills organizations are working to help students get the skills they need. I'm Michael Bassett, and this is Bright Future, a Conference Board of Canada podcast.
My guests this episode are Jane Goodyear, Dean of the Lassonde School of Engineering at York University, and Ian Howcraft, Chief Executive Officer at Skills Ontario. Both of them are actively working to reshape our skills development ecosystem and our labor market preparedness so that they can fill not only the gaps of tomorrow, but the ones that we need today. Jane and Ian, welcome to Bright Future.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yes, thank you so much, Michael. It's good to be here too.
Conference Board of Canada analysis shows that our natural rate of population growth, the births minus the deaths, it's been declining, and we're expecting it to reach zero, which is essentially we're not going to be growing anymore, by 2035 without more people. And economists are concerned about this because it's going to restrict growth. But making sure that those who can work is such a critical issue in this, and particularly making sure that they can find meaningful work and that they're prepared for the work is a challenge that you both are looking at in your own ways. We've been working on this major research initiative called the Future Skills Center. And over the past few years, our education skills research has been conducting research on how Canada can improve our skills ecosystem and identifying the key skills that are going to be needed in the future. Jane, when you hear that context or when you think about these issues, what challenges do you see for yourself and other universities in making sure that skills are aligned to Canada's labor market?
Firstly, I just want to say that we need to recognise that the diversity of the post-secondary providers, universities, colleges, institutes, the diversity is a strength that we need to nurture. Together, we need to work towards responding to this broader societal economic change that we're grappling with. Like any post-secondary institution, we're accountable to the Ministry of Colleges and Universities, and through what we call our strategic mandate agreements. This allows us to focus to tell us to invest in initiatives that result in positive economic and labour market outcomes for students and obviously to the people of Ontario who we're accountable to. The Ministry, a few years ago, linked funding to ensure that our students and the graduates of our programs are actually set up to succeed in hopefully rewarding careers, and that us as post-secondary institutions can demonstrate our economic impact. So this mandate that we've got from the government, it does trickle down and actually challenges me and obviously my colleagues to really think through about how we provide excellent academic programs and that we are doing our best to ensure that our graduates are finding meaningful work and careers. The mandate is challenging us to be innovative and flexible in what we're offering. Going back to the context, it's quite apparent from the government's perspective that they're looking for innovation in the post-secondary sector. For instance, they've launched initiatives such as strengthening Ontario's leadership in virtual learning. They launched a few years ago, but eCampus Ontario. They've now given money to MITAX about creating paid work internships so that our post-secondary students can secure in-demand jobs after graduation. They're also encouraging the development of micro-credentials for short-term education and training programs. There has been, from the government perspective, a real big driver in supporting experiential or work-integrated learning through various tax credits, wage subsidies. as a post-secondary institution, we are working towards these mandates. Employers, for instance, are looking towards me and institutions to produce these highly qualified professionals who will actively participate in their sector's needs and help shape them and hopefully a successful evolution of their business and organisation. The challenge is that the stakes are higher than they were in the past because our world is changing so rapidly. For me and others like me, I think that the key challenge at the moment is how do we keep abreast of what, particularly in engineering, the professional sectors are requiring to future-proof their growth as an organisation, and how do we react quickly to adjusting our programmes or even launching new programmes. And this is my personal view. So this isn't York University or whatever, but as you can tell from my accent, I'm not from around these parts. I'm originally from the UK, but I've spent 12 years working in New Zealand, and I'm going to have to be blunt. I think that the approval processes for creating new programs or requiring major modifications to be more responsive in Ontario is way too long. For example, the Bachelor of Applied Science in Digital Technologies combines full-time paid work with study. That actually took 14 months to go through the various channels and to finally be approved by the Ontario University's Council of Quality Assurance. Now, I know in Australia, we could do that in 4.5 months, just as an example. That's a big challenge to be reactive to what the labour market needs. Another challenge is that if we're to be leaders and really driving, which is what the government's been saying, yeah, we want that, we want to nurture it. Our government systems and funding needs to be flexible too. And this is just one innovation. There's many going on. But I thought that just expanding the boundaries of work integrated learning would be a relatively easy thing to do because it both benefits employers and learners. However, whilst the employers have gone, yeah, we really want to do this, what I've found is that many organisations are reticent of trying something new. There seems to be this challenge of, innovation, this is a bit scary. Am I brave enough to make that jump? And I'm really not seeing that there's any sweetness from the government to actually help people go over that initial scary phase. Going back to the key challenges, I think time for development and being flexible and reactive, but also is this reticent of, yeah, we want innovation, but do we want innovation?
Well, a lot of commonality in Jane's points and mine, but I have a bit of a different perspective because Skills Ontario is not a training organization or an educational organization. We promote skilled trades. We started about 33 years ago to deal with a shortage of skilled trade workers and technology workers. A small competition in Barrie, Ontario that had about 112 students in 7 different areas because there was a shortage and a negative stigma around pursuing a skilled trade career. So we started and we've grown since there. A lot of the challenges continue. We don't have enough people looking at what those opportunities are, what a skilled trade career, a technology career is all about. We are right now at a crucial time and something that I am optimistic about. More people seem to be talking about opportunities in the skilled trades. The challenges are being articulated in the media, the government, particularly right now, take as an example, the housing crisis. People can't find housing. We're going to have a lot of immigration coming in to deal with some of the population and demographic issues that were alluded to earlier. What we need to do is make sure that we have our domestic population looking at these career opportunities, and the new Canadians are also looking at this. And how do we help them? How do we create the support systems to do that? Jane mentioned work integrated learning. I think that's a key opportunity. We need to do more of that. An excellent example of work integrated learning is an apprenticeship. You are working, you're learning, you're earning while you're learning. Great opportunity. But there's been a negative stigma around apprenticeships that many people wouldn't even consider that. And it's not just the students, it's the whole ecosystem and educational system around that. Do we have enough information to teachers to look at what these opportunities are to, if not encourage students to go into the trades or go into a technology career, at least to make them aware of what those opportunities are? We have many people come to us and say, oh, I wish I'd known about that when I was in school, or I didn't know this was an opportunity that I could pursue. And you look at Ontario right now, the average age of somebody starting an apprenticeship is 28. What we would like to do is make sure young people are aware of these opportunities, because if they do want to pursue that, let them get into it at an earlier age. There's a huge opportunity to encourage and make people aware of what these opportunities are for a skilled trade or technology career. We need to make sure parents are aware of that. There was always a, oh, I want my children to go this way. I don't want them to be a blue-collar worker. Again, the stigma is still there, but I think it is lessening. We are seeing these are well-paid jobs that have a career potential for life. There's entrepreneurial opportunities. There's a lot of positives around this that are being discussed more than they were perhaps 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. I'm seeing that we're getting a lot more positive coverage in the media. There's 144 recognized trades in Ontario. Some of them are outdated, but I think there's a lot that are still very, very relevant, still providing huge opportunities, and technology is having a huge impact on what we do. We promote skilled trades and technology careers. There are some careers that are more aligned to just technology, but even traditional trades are embracing and have to embrace technology to be able to deal with that. We always have to work on improving productivity. That's one area where we will be able to address the demographic changes. When we have declining population here, we need to bring in immigration to deal with some of that. And also we need to address some productivity issues that have been longstanding. A lot of challenges, but I'm more encouraged now than I was 10 years ago. And I've been dealing with these issues for many, many years, because I'm seeing that we're not just talking about it now. We're actually taking actions to address some of these issues. A lot more has to be done, but I'm starting to see some actual solutions being introduced, resolutions coming forward, bringing those to fruition rather than just an ongoing dialogue and discussion about what the challenges, what the problems are, how do we address that now, and how do we make sure we have the workforce of the future today that has the competencies they need, the skills that they need, whether they're in a skilled trade, a technology career, or in universities and engineering. We are more aligned with the post-secondary institutions of colleges, some training institutes, but there is a crossover with STEM, engineering, and there is a huge technology opportunity for us to better straddle both sides of the post-secondary educational system. And I'm really encouraged with what's going on, and just have to make sure that we bring that to full fruition.
Both of you talk about how programs are evolving. Ian, what you talked about in terms of the trades not really being something that was presented as an option. When I was in school, they had started to phase out shop classes, and those other ways that people could get exposed to trades just weren't really available to them. And the focus really was on the university. And the university lens seemed to be the only way to do it. But then the university lens was also not seen to be necessarily that direct path to employment. It was really, you know, you go here to learn how to think. And what I'm hearing is on both of your sides, there's quite a lot of change in the space and the ways in which you're thinking about, as institutions, preparing students. Ian, you've talked a little bit about how you see things turning the corner a little bit in perception. Where do you want things to go? Or what are the areas that you think are most important to change in helping people to really understand these options that are available in the trades as real careers for people?
When I was in school, we still had the shop classes, which now are more technology labs as opposed to the shop class. But they were starting to close down, and there wasn't the opportunity for students that came after me to have the same experiential experience that I had in those classes. And we're starting to talk about that now. In Ontario, the Minister of Education announced earlier this year that they're going to require all students to have a technology class. It's going to be part of the curriculum, which we have been long advocating for, and we've been very supportive of. But to do that, have to make sure you have the classes, the labs, and also the teachers to be able to ensure that they're getting the education and the training that they need to do that. We try and encourage students to try a trade. When they're building a new school now, that's something that they do have more focus on. I've been to some schools extremely impressed with what they have, from woodworking and carpentry all the way up to technology and robotics. It's quite impressive in some schools. Others have nothing. What we did in partnership with the government was we built and have what we call our trade and technology truck. and it goes out to schools with a heavy equipment simulator, 3D printer, welding simulators, some information on how you can get to a career with that hands-on opportunity. We host now the largest skills competition in the country. We started in Barrie with 112 students. We now have it at the Toronto Congress Center with almost 2,500 competitors. And before the pandemic, we had almost 40,000 visitors out. It's getting out there, letting people try it, have a hands-on opportunity. The competitors are doing it, but it also brings in tens of thousands of other students to explore and to see what their opportunities are as they pursue their educational career path and hopefully able to have a positive influence on them as they deal with that. We just announced 2 weeks ago that we're building three more of these experiential technology trailers and trucks, which we'll have next summer. So we'll have four of them out. Still a small number of students relative to the 2 million students in Ontario's public school system. We have seen over 50,000 people on that one truck so far in the year and a half since it was launched. I'm encouraged by the receptivity to this type of approach by the students, by the teachers, by the guidance counselors. For the first time, we had a conference for guidance counselors, guidance educators at our competition. We thought, what better way to let them know about these opportunities than to bring them out to tour around the 76 different contest sites that we're hosting. We weren't sure how many we would get, but we had 520 guidance counselors register for the event. So we were overwhelmed by the positive response we got, and it gave us the opportunity to engage with guidance counselors, to engage with more teachers. We work very closely with the OEAP, the apprenticeship folks, and the Technology Teachers Association, the dual credit system, the SHSM system, special high skilled majors. But we're looking to do as much as we can to provide information, to provide support to all teachers so that in the schools, students are aware of all opportunities that they could pursue, what their interests are. Somebody might love to be an electrician or a mechatronics person, but if they don't know about that, it's an opportunity lost. So what we do is promote the skilled trades in a variety of ways, going into schools, holding competitions, having trade and technology days. We have focused programming for girls and young women, for FNMI Indigenous youth. We've expanded into cover for BIPOC and DE&I. There's a lot of things that we're doing now, and it's resonating with the audiences. So that's why I'm encouraged, but a lot more has to be done. Talk is great, but we have to follow up with action and results.
Jane, you talked a little bit about this program that you're launching this year, this Digital Technologies Work Integrated Learning Program. Tell me about this program, and as you're telling this story, talk to me about how university programming or this thinking about the role of universities is also evolving.
Before I talk more about the new program, let's think about how typically university programming has actually involved businesses and having students work whilst they're at school. We know that this has been conducted in universities and colleges through Canada's tried and trusted co-op program, which has been around since 1957. It's world renowned. 80% of the province's post-secondary institutions offer this kind of learning model. We also know, because it's been around for many, many decades, that there are challenges. And one particular challenge is that the recruitment and onboarding of learners into a co-op program takes energy and resources. A co-op student, on average, spending 8 months working at a company. Some are only 4 months, some are a lot longer, but let's say 8 months. When I go and speak to employers about, we can help support your co-op program and offer you some great students, they lament all the time is just when we've got that student to start producing and they've got the lay of the land and they've got their feet under the table, they then have to go back to you. And so this challenge, it's great, don't get me wrong, and I think the co-op and intern program is here to stay. But what I'm trying to bring to the fore in Canada is to say, because the work and academic experiences are defined in separate domains, I challenge that it's mainly serendipity that the academic learning can be then directly applied into the workplace, because they're not purposely designed to be fully integrated. And I want to echo some words of Stan Lester and Daryl Bravenbrough, who were well known in the UK on their thinking on vocational and work-based learning. And that is, we need to facilitate a reconstituted notion of post-secondary education that recognises the workplace as a source of learning rather than a site for its application. This is very pertinent to our current degree programmes that have some form of work-based learning, and I'm challenging that notion. What is actually unique about this integrated program? I've played on the spectrum of work integrated learning. So you've got the light touch of work where you might have somebody from a company who comes in to do a presentation to, you know, we do a project with a company to an intern, a co-op, to the full work integrated learning, which is an apprenticeship, to be honest with you. But I've just called them a fully work integrated learning program. This program combines full-time paid work with study. It's based on a highly successful proven model in the UK. As I said, they're called degree apprenticeships, which offer degree level and master's level programs in this kind of integrated model. And the first tranche of these programs were rolled out in 2015 in the UK, and they now have grown to over 22,000 learners across England. This model, students work full-time with approximately 20% of their work time dedicated to theoretical in-class learning, which is delivered. It can either be a day release, but we're going to do it on a five-day block periods every 6 weeks. And they study towards a Bachelor of Applied Science in this digital technology degree. Software developers, cybersecurity specialists, and data scientists. The rest of their work hours, they'll be spent in the workplace where the academic learning is continuously applied and integrated as they gain experience and contribute to their employer's goals. And because the students actually essentially work in full time, the reason that this program is so valuable is that not only are the students growing technically, but they're growing into that organizational culture. The employers get an opportunity to move the student around based on the need of the organization without having to lose them every 4 months or 8 months or whatever. We are finding in the UK is translating to loyalty and retention of talent. And that helps them because they then don't have to invest in hiring and rehiring every term or every cycle. What is good about this kind of programming? It's designed to help employers upskill their existing workforce, but they also have access to new talent pipelines as well. It should be really powerful on increasing equity, diversity, and inclusion by opening doors to those who have not considered degree education, particularly in STEM, because let's face it, you're earning while you're learning. You're getting that technology-based qualification and you're not going to go into debt. This could be a game changer for those who economically could just never afford post-secondary education. I'm seeing this as, even though we're starting in one area, digital technologies, I've seen it spread to other occupations from policing, nursing, to social work. It could be a scalable model for Canada. That's what I'm hoping to see.
Both in your own ways have talked about the systems and the structures that are there to help students choose different paths and get opportunities that lead to work. The other side of that is the kinds of skills that people are actually getting. And the sense is, certainly from Conference Board research, that the skills of the future are very different than maybe what we might have thought. At some point, we thought that it was computer programming or any of those really technical skills. Our research is finding that social and emotional skills, so whether it's critical thinking or leadership, those are the skills that we're seeing as critical for success. I guess, number one, does that align with your experience around the kinds of skills that are needed for the future? And if so, Do you think post-secondary institutions are effectively prioritizing the development of skills? And post-secondary writ large, obviously, any of those institutions that are building and supporting skills, to help ensure that students understand and are well prepared for a career path that looks very different from a traditional path that folks are looking at. How well do you think the institutions are addressing those skills?
I think it's becoming more prevalent across the sector. For engineering, and I presume other professions, it's always been a requirement to integrate such skills to gain accreditation. But if we look more broadly, all Ontario post-secondary institutions, we are actually guided by the Ontario Council of Academic Vice Presidents for university degree level expectations. And these expectations elaborate very clearly the intellectual and creative development of the student and the acquisition of relevant skills. In these guidelines, and I'll just talk about honours degree programmes, there's an expectation that there will, to quote, we will develop in a programme, doesn't matter what subject area, we have to develop critical thinking and analytical skills inside and outside the discipline. We have to develop communication skills and autonomy and professional capacity. So that is like set in stone. As institutions, academic programming, we have to demonstrate those in everything we do for the graduates to attain those kinds of skills and attributes. That's the bigger piece. Let me go more into detail about when we're developing a program, such as this digital technologies integrated program. We've actually gone a step further. York University academics, my colleagues in the Lausanne School of Engineering, and senior tech experts from the various sectors in ICT to develop this program of various sizes and also geographic areas. We came together and we became a team of trailblazers. We're called trailblazers. And there were 15 employer representatives of these senior tech people from these companies, such as Ceridian, Cisco, CGI, RBC, GM, Shopify, TELUS Health, and even some smaller organisations such as Sardini and Connected. We worked together as trailblazers very collaboratively to specify the knowledge, skills, and behaviours expected from the graduates of this program to become software developers, to become cybersecurity analysts or data scientists. We have taken account of these more social and emotional skills that employers are expecting. They're expecting our graduates to be competent in active listening and in leading, influencing and persuading others. They're expecting that our graduates can identify the preferences, motivations, strengths and limitations of other people and apply these insights to work more effectively with and to motivate others. They're also expecting our graduates to understand the importance of how to support diversity and inclusion and how to constructively resolve conflicts, particularly in teams. As post-secondary institutions, we're realising the world is really quickly changing. More needs to be done to prepare students for the opportunities and the challenges that lie ahead. We're sitting down with employers to thrash out the expectations. Is it a good thing? And we're getting a direct conduit for continuous feedback because we're more closer with employers. Allows us as an academic institution to understand what the gaps are, experiencing that in real time so that we can act towards it. I think these kinds of programs, the more work integrated learning we're open to, I think it just benefits for that challenge you set us, Michael.
Ian, what about you? How is the skills mix that you're seeing in the delivery systems for the trades? Are there areas where you feel you'd like to see more focus on?
I agree with everything that Jane said. We're in a little bit of a different situation. We're promoting the skilled trades and technology career paths for young people to explore and consider. But we also, at the same time, think that to be really successful or to maximize the opportunities, you need to have what are called the essential skills or skills for success. Some used to call it the soft skills. These were important skills, particularly around communication. If you don't have the full set of communication skills, literary skills, then you're not going to realize the full potential that you could do. So we try and include that in our work. I'm with Skills Ontario, but there's a skills organization in every jurisdiction in Canada and a national Skills Canada that we work with to coordinate our offerings. Skills for Success is a big part of what we're trying to promote to make sure young people are getting the full package. You certainly need to be able to do the skills of the jobs, have the competencies to do a skill trade or even a technology career. But how do you make sure that you're maximizing that and continuing to grow and to learn? You need these other skill sets that Jane clearly articulated. Another area that's probably included in this is leadership. We're trying to do more on the leadership side. Make sure people understand the tenets of leadership so that, well, you could be a leader or you can at least work for an organization that you're going to help move forward on that leadership continuum. Teamwork is extremely important. We've just gone through a terrible pandemic where people had to find new and different ways to do work. And I think we need to do more now to bring teams together. We need to also make sure that people can work in a team as we move forward back to hopefully more normal times. That's a big part of what we're trying to do. We promote the skill trade, the technology aspects, but we're also looking at essential skills, skills for success, leadership, communication, those other aspects that one would need in order to be really successful in their job and continue to grow. Some people are very happy. I want to do this. That's all I want to do. But most people say, I want to do this now, but what are the other opportunities? What are the other things that I can do? How can I build my career? One, for moving up, for more enjoyment, for more challenge, for more compensation, perhaps. But I think that's something that we need to ensure young people are getting is that full package of skills and competencies. And I'm seeing more educators, more schools talk about this and try and embrace this. From my perspective, the educational, the training system in Ontario and in Canada is quite complicated. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of organizations dealing with it. When I first came to Skills Ontario, I've been here about 5 years now, my mantra was the three C's, cooperation, coordination, collaboration. How can we better leverage what each of us are doing without duplicating and competing? How do we leverage what other organizations are doing so that we can take the investments that are being made and take them to maximum impact for the system so that people leave the system with an educational and a career perspective in mind that's taking advantage of the competencies they have in the technical side, but also in the leadership side, in the communication side, in learning to work with people, lead teams, and deal with teams in the workplace. It's going to become even more important as we move forward. And I'm encouraged by seeing more and more people talk about these aspects and these issues in a very productive way.
We both talked about the change, and the biggest change that we've seen this year, maybe not in terms of practical application, but certainly in terms of discussion, has been the release of AI tools, such as ChatGPT, that have raised this discussion around AI taking over an increasingly diverse set of jobs and promising, whether that's hype or it's actual promise, to revolutionize work. Drawing from your extensive experience, what do you see in terms of this conversation around artificial intelligence? How's it starting to shape things for you as you look at the skill sets that you're building, the programs you're developing, or is it just too early?
We're monitoring it, trying to educate ourselves as to what it will do to impact what we're doing. And we always try and look at what are the competitions and the skills that we're promoting now, but what will they be in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years from now and into the future? I mean, we started with the traditional millwright, tool and die, carpentry, and we still have them. They're still important, crucial skills that we need now. But we've also added robotics, mechatronics, cloud computing, 2D animation, 3D animation, a whole lot of technical skills. That's going to continue. We're going to have to be mindful of AI and how that's going to impact us. It is going to change things. I don't think we all know how much yet. I think it will have a significant impact on everyone and all organizations in the world of work to varying degrees, depending on what it is that one is studying, pursuing, or practicing. What we're looking at is how do we introduce that to our work? We will work with the school boards. We will work with the schools. We'll work with the government as we try and ensure that young people are aware of all career opportunities. as we go forward. We're also looking at the decarbonization, green energy. How is this impacting the skills that we need and the opportunities that are being created by these changes? It's a threat to some, but it's also an opportunity for others, as things will always continue to evolve even more quickly. How do we make sure that we're addressing that, that we're embracing, if not that particular issue, embracing the opportunity that are created? And how do we make sure that young people are aware of those opportunities and new jobs and new skills that they may need to get as we move forward?
As my role of Dean of Engineering, I'm always looking at the latest reports, keeping abreast, making sure my colleagues are up to speed of what's being said. And I agree with some findings earlier this year of the World Economic Forum's Future of Jobs report, which has clearly identified analytical thinking and creative thinking are the most important skills needed by employers globally. And then they were followed by self-efficacy skills, including resilience, flexibility, agility, motivation and self-awareness, and curiosity and lifelong learning. These things, I'm constantly top of mind about how we're going to grapple and achieve all these things. On top of those skills, the fastest growing roles globally in the next 5 years are technology related roles, such as AI and machine learning specialists, sustainability specialists, business intelligence specialists, information security analysts. They're the five big growing roles, but also renewable energy engineers, solar energy installation system engineers, because economies are shifting to renewable energy. This is allowing me as a leader to think through, well, how are we going to meet these demands in the future? We're increasingly focused on work integrated learning experiences, and I see that trend will continue to grow and flourish. We've got an opportunity by developing collaboratively our programming with technology experts and leaders from cutting-edge organizations will just allow us to ensure our learners are well prepared for the future ahead.
So you both actually talked about the role that you see diversity playing and increasing diversity in your respective areas. Both of those fields that you're primarily representing, whether it's STEM and engineering or trades, they've been criticized in the past for not being diverse. Do you think that these areas are making enough progress? And in talking about the progress that you've seen and maybe where we need to continue to move, tell me a little bit about why this is so important, because it did come across as a really important topic for both of you.
DE&I is important to Skills Ontario. We have that as one of our foundational skills. We put everything that we're doing through a DE&I lens, and we look at what we can do to make sure that we're reaching out to various communities to make sure we're tapping into all pools of potential interested individuals, future workers. There's still an awful lot of work that has to be done. We've had a young women's program for many years, an Indigenous program for many years. We're reaching out, trying to better engage girls and young women in skilled trades and technologies, some of them with Indigenous youth. In fact, the Indigenous youth is the only growing community in Canada. What we need to do is make sure that we're engaging with those groups, getting the information to them, letting them know about that, and providing conduits for them to experience, have a hands-on opportunity. We work with various reserves, band councils. We have a fast-growing Indigenous conference that we hold at our competition. In fact, we have to explore moving to a bigger room now because we had a sellout crowd. I'm encouraged, but there's an awful lot still to be done. There's still some stigma attached to the skilled trades that it's not friendly for women. I think we have to address that. I think the Ontario government should be recognized for some of the changes it's made and making sure that the safety equipment is available and will fit all body types. Our director of competition is a woman named Jennifer Green. She's an industrial millwright by trade. She's been working with us for 5 years running our competition. She told me that the number of women in her trade, millwrights, has doubled. Wow, that's very impressive. It's gone from 3% to, I think, 6%. Yes, it's going in the right direction, but it's going perhaps not as quickly as we need or as quickly as we like. Given the shortage of skills, we have to make sure that we're reaching out to all communities to make sure that we're doing that. We've expanded our D&I programs to now include BIPOC youth, persons with exceptionalities and disabilities, new Canadians coming here. How do we help them integrate, give them the information to find information about their educational pathways and their career pathways? It is something that we are all talking about. We're all trying to take actions on, and we are seeing some results, but we have to really dedicate the investments and the resources if we're going to realize the results that we need to address the skills shortage and the changing economy.
Oh, I'm going to be blunt here. It's terrible. I'm a woman engineer. I was in the automotive industry and in the late 80s, I'm giving my age away now. And to be honest with you, I mean, the figures of from Engineers Canada in 2020, just less than 21% of newly licensed engineers were female identified. We've been working on this for 30 years, putting a lot of resources into this to solve it. And really what is going on, it's about the pipeline. We've got these targets, but it starts at the K-12 system, because if the pipeline isn't big, they're never going to go it. And I'm going to give you some numbers here. This is how bad it is. This is based on 2016 statistics, and it's only focused on Ontario high schools. So during 2016, there were 193,605 students studying grade 12 in Ontario schools. So let's say 200,000, you know, round up. For engineering, I'm just talking engineering. We know that students need grade 12 physics. 13% of all grade 12 students studied physics, and 2.9% of the grade 12 population that enroll in engineering programs of women, less than 2%. At the end of K-12, if we then try to say we wanted equity in engineering programs across Ontario, do you realize if we move the numbers back to say if we kept everything the same, the pipeline's leaking all over the place, so it's still the same, we would need to roughly double our population of students taking science at grade 10, or force every student in the high school system to study grade 11 physics. That's how bad the problem is. This is why it's not just me in engineering, but others are really working hard in the K-12 sector. We need more physics teachers. We need more maths teachers. We need families to be happy and comfortable around STEM and whatever. How are we going to create this ecosystem that doesn't push kids out to not be afraid of STEM? And I'm not saying everybody's going to be in STEM or anything like that, but and it's only just dawned on me the last few years that there's a systemic issue we've got to deal with in the K-12 system, because then me and Ian, we're the receivers of that system. I can't magic up women or Indigenous students out of the air. I'd love to, but I can't do that. That is a real challenge, and it's something I've been spending 30 years and I still haven't done it. I'm going to manage to shift the needle, I promise. So that's where I'm coming from.
Well, a lot of what we've talked about so far is sort of that traditional, you go to school and then you get a skill and then you get to work. And we had futurist Sinead Bovell on this program. And so she had a lot of thoughts on the skills that are required, the way that people need to think about skills. But one of the things that she argued is that this traditional model of learning and then working and then retiring, she considers it either to be dead or on its deathbed or on its way out. And the argument that she puts forward is people really need to start thinking not necessarily in that model where they've done their schooling, now they get their career, but they have to start understanding that, you know, you're going to have to go back and you're going to come in and out of the education system as the world of work changes, as skills requirements change. How well do you see institutions dealing with this future where that learning stage is something that people are going to have to be able to come in and out of, and the work stage is going to have to play much more nicely with the education stage?
They've talked about it for a long time. It's not really new, but lifelong learning. You'll always have to upgrade your skill set, update your competencies if you want to be relevant and continue to move forward in your particular career path. And I think we have moved in that direction, but there's probably a lot more that has to be done. The education system needs to change to allow opportunities for people to come back more easily, to tie in with people's lifestyles, commitments. It's not just a 9-to-5 school system. You need to have other opportunities. And I know a lot of organizations, a lot of institutions do that with night learning, special classes. It is an ongoing issue that you're going to have to continue to update your skill sets, update your competencies, continue with learnings, skills change, technology change. So you're going to have to be able to adjust that, or you'll find yourself in a diminished role or looking for a new role without the skill sets that you need to be successful. I agree with that direction that's been started for quite a few years.
Jane, what about you? How well do you think people are doing on this?
I think we could do better as an education system. And this is from zero to end of life, if you know what I mean. What's missing is that we really need to take a holistic look at the education system from elementary high school through to obtaining qualifications that go right up to master's and PhD, and how we blend vocational learning into that framework. I personally like the Germanic countries' dual system. So this is Germany, Switzerland, Austria. Their approach is that they have an academic and vocational professional stream. So this is the dual system that progresses up the educational ladder. For instance, if we just look at Germany, they have an 8-level national qualifications framework for lifelong learning. That framework aims to increase transparency and comparability of qualifications and permeability in their education training system, to increase skill and learning outcomes for the qualifications that are supporting the learner's journey, their mobility, and their journey through lifelong learning. It also aims to support the validation of non-formal and informal learning by acting as a guiding tool in the identification and assessment of skills during validation. And one key principle of this framework is that each qualification level should be accessible via various educational pathways. In Ontario, have we designed our education system like that? That's what I'm questioning. And I think we really do have an opportunity to work across ministries, because again, we're working across various ministries, but are we looking at it holistically? I'm a very strong advocate of the holistic viewpoint of how we should be looking at our education system. Very strong believer in needing to work together to produce highly qualified professionals. Us as universities, we can't do this alone. So we must work hand in hand with employers, policymakers, industry associations, and governments to succeed. So we need to do more of this. I don't think we're doing a bad job in work integrated learning. You know, our co-op interns, we're getting a lot of support and funding, but can we do more? You've picked up, I'm very passionate about our new integrated degree program. And I want to end by a quote from Robert Halfen, who is the Minister for Skills, Apprenticeships and Higher Education in the UK. And he said this in February. I have two favourite words, degree and apprenticeship. And it's really great to see universities and businesses coming together to discuss how we can grow these fantastic qualifications. My plea is this integrated model an opportunity for institutions to strengthen partnerships with employers? And if so, we need the Canadian government, both federally, provincially, to learn and understand more about this model. And can it be a catalyst for having a more holistic view of how we get this transparency, mobility, and that this lifelong learning approach to our education system, not just in Ontario, but across Canada.
Ian, what would be your last word in terms of the advice you would have for educational institutions, employers, or policymakers?
Collaboration, cooperation, coordination. We need to talk about partnership, but actually action that again. I'm encouraged by seeing more businesses getting involved. When I started my career working for a manufacturing association 35 years ago, skill shortage was the number one issue. But I don't think there was a lot of dialogue between the manufacturers or the university or the college. I've seen that dramatically change. And there's a lot more integration now, a lot more discussion, a lot more work, a lot more partnerships between the educational institutions and the business community, the business organizations. It used to be businesses would offer, hey, we need new equipment for productivity improvements. We'll give you our old junk. And the schools was, oh, well, I guess that's all we have is better than nothing. But now I've seen schools say, no, we don't want that. We want the new stuff. We want what you're putting into your manufacturing facility. We want that in our school. We need that in our school. So you're seeing that collaboration, I think, take a more concrete footing in the systems. I think we need to do more of that. We need to bring in the education, the business communities together, and with government. We need labor, workers. I think we need to bring it all together so that we are moving in the same direction. In Canada, we have the other dimension, the Constitution. We have the federal government involved. We have the provincial government involved, and you have to make sure you're in the right track, but we still need to collaborate. The feds seem to have all the money and the province all the responsibility when it comes to education and training, but we need to find a way to collaborate and move these things forward. Again, I'm encouraged by seeing some of the initiatives out there. Work integrated learning, apprenticeship seems to be having a rebirth. There's a lot more that we still need to do in that direction, but I think we're at the point now where we no longer have the luxury of time and we have huge shortages and we need to address that. So hopefully that's an impetus for us all to continue to move forward and come up with solutions.
I want to thank you both for engaging in this wide-ranging conversation. I really appreciate the thoughtfulness of both of your responses and hearing from leaders who are putting in place systems and programs and changes that are going to be addressing our needs and helping us to move forward as a country. So thank you both so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Bright Future from the Conference Board of Canada. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Let us know how we're doing. The views expressed by our guests are theirs alone and do not reflect the Conference Board's research or opinion. For more podcasts, research, commentary, and ideas, visit conferenceboard.ca.